he speaks. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our next speaker, who's going to give us a very interesting talk on what doctors need to hear and what nurses need to say. So essentially, what doctors and their interactions with the healthcare professional, when it occurs, what they really need to know and what they want to hear, and he will give us tips and tricks, perhaps, and frameworks to better frame how that process should take place. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Dabrowski, who is an emergency care, pediatric emergency care specialist at the Montreal Children's Hospital. He works as well in the inpatient setting at the Montreal Children's Hospital. Sasha works in the interprofessional teams and is actively involved in the quality improvement projects to improve nurse-physician communication in order to maximize patient safety. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Dabrowski. Thank you.
Does everyone hear me? Yes? All right. So good morning. So I'm Sasha Dabrowski. Like I mentioned, I'm mainly a pediatric eMERGE doc, although I do a lot of hospitalist stuff as well. And we're going to explore what doctors need to hear and nurses need to say. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. That was good. I do have multiple biases, though. I need to disclose one is I'm a hospital-based physician, and so much of what I'm going to share with you in my journey into nurse-physician collaboration comes from the hospital perspective, although I am certain that there are many parallels and similarities to what goes on in the community settings. I'm also a graduate of the year 2004, and so I offer the perspective of a relatively recent graduate. And lastly, I am not an expert in communication. I am not an expert in patient safety. I have erred, I have miscommunicated, and I probably will continue to do so even though I'm committed to this cause. Because I'm an advocate that healthcare teams really need to strive for better. We need to ensure and recognize that effective teams, such as the Canadians Armed Forces Search and Rescue Team, spend hours every single day training on how to better communicate, such that when a situation arises and communication is critical, that it is done well so that a safe and effective outcome is maintained. So throughout my talk, and it's mainly through storytelling that I'm going to help this audience gain insight into the minds of a physician during interprofessional exchanges, I'd like to define what I think is interprofessional collaboration. And again, through storytelling, we'll explore what physicians need to hear, nurses need to say, and I will have some suggested strategies for improvement. And it was a very opportune time when I met a patient who would have resembled the handicaps of this picture. I was in the surgical fast track of our emergency room where this boy fell out of his wheelchair, and the mom brought him in saying, well, does he have any fractures or whatnot? And it was very clear after a very quick story and exam that he was fine. And for whatever reason, I had asked her, well, why does your son have cerebral palsy? And what she answered really astonished me, because she said a series of miscommunications. And the story goes essentially a routine vaginal delivery. She was there, and all of a sudden there was a bit of fetal distress on the monitor. The team recognized that there was a cord prolapse and called for a stat C-section. And then they waited and waited and waited. And what happened is apparently the OR never got the message. And so what was the outcome was the baby delivered flat, requiring resuscitation, with obvious hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy and an outcome that was far from expected. Now, none of us go into healthcare in our line of work to cause such harm. We've all chosen our professions because we all want to care for people. And what we need to recognize is that we're human, that errors are inevitable, and that we need to ensure systems are in place that help us ensure that we could withhold the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm. As Mark Daly presented and Sean Clark, preventable communication errors are at the root of over two-thirds of reported sentinel events, and so this is a good place where we need to work. Now, many of us are aspiring to provide patient and family-centered care. I think patients are demanding we do so, and they're still reporting that we have a long way to go. Now, patient-centered care is not a new concept. It is merely that over time, many barriers and competing interests that are beyond the scope of this talk have worked against its advancement. Now, patient family-centered care is said to occur when healthcare teams, work in partnership with patients and families. And it has been shown in multiple study settings that when it's done well, it improves healthcare quality and safety. It decreases costs, and it improves satisfaction of all people involved. The key, however, is a healthcare team. And healthcare teams need, as defined by Team Steps, which is actually an evidence-based teamwork curriculum developed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, as well as the Department of Defense Patient Safety Program in the U.S., I think over about a decade ago, define high-performing teams as having four elements. You need to have an effective leader. You need to provide each other mutual support. Use structured communication strategies and to develop shared situational awareness. And for sure, when you have multiple professions on a team, you need to ensure that there's interprofessional collaboration. And now that is said to exist when two or more members of different healthcare professions work together jointly to solve problems or provide services with a common goal. And effective collaboration requires shared power and authority based on knowledge and expertise, needs to have trust, mutual respect, and joint contributions. And like I mentioned, effective communication is key. Now, communication. At its most basic level, we all know, has a sender, a message, and a receiver. It seems very simple, but we know that it's not, because interpersonal communication relies on a lot more. It's about what you say, when you say it, how you say it, what you've chosen not to say, and more importantly, it's also based on your body language and on the nonverbal, because that has a huge impact on the relationship between the sender and the receiver. Now, this quote by Sidney Harris describes two words, information and communication. Now, these two words are often used interchangeably, but they actually signify quite different things. Information is giving out, communication is getting through. I cannot tell you how many times I'm in the hospital and a nurse comes up to me and says, you know, Sasha, I just want to tell you about Johnny. His heart rate is 140. He's breathing at rate of 40. He's on statin at 96% with 1 liter of oxygen. He has a fever of 39.5. I've given him Tylenol. Thank you very much. Walks away. Later I read in the note, MD aware. MD aware of what? Was I supposed to act on something? Was she asking me to confirm that this is normal or abnormal state? I don't know. And this happens on a daily basis. So nurse-physician communication in the literature, as was summarized by Sean Clark, there are many studies reporting on the benefits of positive interactions and on the detriments of negative interactions. We know it improves quality of patient care. It improves patient safety, patient satisfaction. It decreases errors, length of stay, costs, morbidity, and mortality. That is clear. From the nursing perspective, it improves learning, teamwork, the ability to act rapidly, and it allows nurses to participate in all phases of care. It improves nurse satisfaction. It improves nurse retention. And by consequence, it decreases burnout and sick calls. It decreases costs to the nursing department to train new nurses as a result. From the physician perspective, similarly, it improves our learning, our teamwork, efficiency, satisfaction. I got to tell you, it improves frustration, because when I'm on a care team that has poor communication, I leave every day to Sandy and I say, oh my God, what was wrong with this team today? Now, why are we struggling? Well, we've kind of already heard a little bit that communication between professionals is dependent on the willingness to communicate with each other, the ability to use assertive language, to be motivated to communicate with each other. We can't be apprehensive when we're going up to the other profession and say, oh, I'm scared what that person's going to say. Are they going to lash out? Because if you have that, it's not going to happen. And you need to have a team with good job morale, and you also have to have a team that understands each other's roles. Because without that, it's really unclear what we're communicating about. Now, this is a quote that was published in a Journeying Nurse, along with the results of a survey that was sent over to over 1,000 nurses. And I'll read it to you. Recently, my father was hospitalized for an extended period. He was surprised at how hard the nurses worked and how little he saw the doctors. I never knew what nursing was all about, he told his nurse. Don't worry, sir, she replied. Neither do the doctors. So let's explore a little bit about the history of the nurse-physician dynamic to try to gain insight into why we're struggling and where we could move forward. And in 1967, Stein wrote, an editorial or an article about the doctor-nurse game. Now, at that time, most physicians were male, most nurses were female, and there was an interesting interaction historically. And so Stein broke it down into a game, where the object of the game was that both participants must be acutely sensitive to each other's nonverbal and often cryptic verbal communications. The nurse needed to be bold, take initiative, be responsible for making recommendations, however, at the same time, had to appear passive so that her recommendation appeared to be initiated by the physician. The physician, in requesting a recommendation from the nurse, had to do so without appearing to be asking for it. The cardinal rule of the game is that open disagreement between the players had to be avoided at all costs. If the nurse is your ally, you've got it made. And if she has it in for you, be prepared for misery. The pictures don't come out. I was going to actually read you an excerpt from the article, and I encourage everyone to look it up. It was really well written. But instead, I was going to ask you to reflect whether these interactions still occur today, and it was just so clear to me that it still does. Dr. Dubrovsky, are you sure you want to order 10 milligrams of IV morphine for this 10-year-old patient? I guess not. Now imagine she would have said, or he would have said, you know, Sasha, I noted you ordered 10 milligrams of IV morphine for John, who weighs 35 kilos. I'd suggest either decreasing it to a safer dose of 0.1 milligrams per kilo per dose, which would be 3.5 milligrams of IV morphine, or if we go orally, then we can give 0.3 milligrams per kilo, which would be the 10 milligrams orally. It would be much different communication, and really, she caught it. The nurse would have made the assessment and just communicated clearly, because I could have equally have said, yes, I want to order 10 milligrams of IV morphine, and walked away, not really realizing that IV to the PO was just an error on my part. Now, over the next few decades, the nurses continued to pursue the advancement of their profession. They advanced degrees at the university level, advocating for their professional roles and autonomy within healthcare teams, and demanding that the hierarchical structures of the classic doctor-nurse relationship be eliminated. Now, this changing relationship has forced a move towards more collaboration. The question is, how are we doing? Now, I don't have the high-quality studies that Sean presented, but there is a study that was sent out to over 1,000 nurses, I think, electronically, and therefore can be only taken as an interesting look. And they repeated the study over a period of a decade. And when nurses were asked, are you satisfied with the professional relationship with doctors, depends on whether you look at the glass half full or half empty, because about 50% said they are satisfied, but about 50% were not satisfied. Now, while the trends are improving and some centers such as Magnet Centers are reporting 80% satisfaction, I'd argue that if 1 in 5 nurses are not satisfied, that is not a place that we should aspire to be. Now, amongst those dissatisfied, about 70% reported physicians displayed unprofessional behaviors, demeaning, dismissive, intimidating. That is a non-acceptable thing. About half treated with disrespect or condescension. Not acceptable. We should have zero tolerance for that. Doctors still talk down and see us as beneath them, was reported. Doctors lack respect for nurses as knowledgeable professionals. Now, when asked to characterize from the nursing perspective what their relationship was with physicians, what I was surprised is that about 50% still reported that they felt they are subordinates to physicians, or they were made to feel that they were subordinates to physicians. And about 30%, on a positive spin, did feel they had collegial relationships with physicians. And when they looked at that group who was answering, they tended to come from intensive care units, which already had very collaborative work environments and teams. When asked, do you think doctors understand what nurses do? 70% reported they do not. Not surprising. When asked, do you think doctors respect your professional judgment? 70% did. So on one hand, I have no idea what you do, but I do respect your judgment. And I really do think that this is really hitting home. Strategies for change that have been suggested in multiple articles after this and editorials is we need to continue to empower nurses, we need to educate physicians, we need to improve communication, and we need to build interprofessional teams. So I'm going to share with you a number of stories, and through these stories, we'll talk about some things. I just want to make sure I don't miss anything. So, about a year ago, I took over the care at noon at the surgical emerge in our hospital, which basically we see injuries. And I got handed over a patient that was 10 years old, had fallen on his head, and was acting very concussed. And it wasn't clear whether he had a bleed or not, and we really are very sensitive to radiation risks of CT. So we said, let's put it in our observation area, see what happens over the next hour or two, and it'll declare itself whether we need to act differently. Now, I get to the care area, and I see a very anxious mom caring for her 10-year-old son who's vomiting, seems agitated, is just not with it. And when I try to speak to this boy, he's not answering any questions. And I instantly made a decision that this kid needs to be transferred to the crash room, and we need to get an urgent CT scan. And because he's vomiting and he's agitated, we probably have to sedate him, and I may need to take over his airway to protect him. I just made a potential error number one, because I did not go and collaborate with the nurse who was watching that patient for the past 2 or 3 hours. I didn't ask her what her opinion was or his. Was he improving? Maybe this was just a bad moment in time. Nonetheless, when I got to the crash room, I did discuss with both the nurses and the family, and we collectively agreed it would be best to intubate and sedate him for the CT scan. The nurses were getting the medications ready for intubation, the RT was getting the equipment ready, the coordinator was helping me communicate to the ICU, neurosurgery, CT scan. The patient actually started to get much more sleepy. And my worry for him was that he was about to crash on us. And I couldn't understand why the medications for intubation were not ready yet. And I actually was annoyed. And I just created another error because, one, I didn't communicate to my team that I'm worried he's deteriorating actively now and we need to up the ante and work faster. And the other error I made is I didn't actually explore what was the problem, what were happening with the medications. So to make matters worse then, the pediatric emerge fellow that was working with me comes to me and says, I'd like to do the intubation. Now, unfortunately, the week prior to that, I did an intubation with him where he really royally messed it up, and his skill needs to be improved in a simulation center, not in a patient. And that increased my anxiety, and I created another error. I didn't communicate to my team that we will still allow him to do this and we need to really offer him more guidance. And the other error I did is I didn't recognize or acknowledge how this anxiety was going to impact on my ability to lead the team and to communicate effectively. So there he is, he's intubating the patient, finally things are moving forward, and from the back of me, I remember a senior nurse yells out, the saturation is 95%. To which I respond, I don't need to know the saturation of 95%, I want quiet in the room. Potential error number 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Because what I effectively did was make that particular nurse feel denigrated. I created a hierarchical barrier that no one was going to communicate with me if they needed to. And I put the patient's life at high risk. And fortunately, from then moving forward, things went well from the patient's perspective. And an hour later when I was sitting there, I was like, well, that went well. And however, I felt like an ass. And so what I then went on to do is go talk to that senior nurse and explain to her all the stuff that was going on in my mind and the concerns I had. And I actually was just really trying to justify my reaction and my sad comment. And exchanging these views, she pointed out that I hadn't shared with my team any of these concerns or my thoughts, and that while I might not have needed to know the SAT of 95%, a better response could have been, thanks for that update. I right now don't need to know the SAT is 95%, but if you can let me know when it's 87%, and at that point, I will stop and reassess. Because that would have given the team a shared situational awareness of what would make me do something differently, as well as allow her and the rest of the team an opportunity to let me know when things aren't going well. I needed to hear her concern during the case. She was concerned. And in the subsequent day or two, because I had just debriefed one-on-one with her, I had to now go and find the rest of the team members and debrief with them as well. And I had asked her to help me in that cause, which we did, and I sought each team member and I apologized. And I opened the dialogue about the type of communication we should be having with each other. And the discussion and the debrief as a team opened the door to a much bigger opportunity, one in which we now learn how do we work, how we think, and how to communicate with each other. Many of us are in the emerge now are trying, both nurses and physicians, are trying to create this culture in which we collectively reflect on what worked well, what didn't, what can we improve, otherwise known as a debrief. Now, for now, most of us are debriefing after major events, although a lot of people in industry and who manage effective teams will say that probably we should be debriefing on an everyday basis. Because what if there was a near miss or a miscommunication or another issue that arises? And if we can't debrief and communicate on a daily basis in our routines, forget about communicating well during critical situations. Now, as part of our trauma quality improvement program, Violaine Vestel, who's in the audience, who's a pediatric emergency educator, together we coordinate an interprofessional simulation program. Now, the objective of these mock codes, essentially, or trauma codes, is not as much trauma resuscitation and medical nursing interventions. It's more learning how to function as a team, communicating effectively with one another, and helping ensure we have shared mental models of the situation. One common scenario we used to encounter both clinically and in simulated environments was that the emerge doc starts off with managing the case, orders a series of medications, the nurses are getting it ready, then in comes the trauma team leader, says, I would like another set of medications. No problem, the nurses get the medications ready, and then we're all sitting there waiting to intubate the patient, and why are the medications not ready? Team leader is frustrated and saying, well, I can't believe that emerge doc didn't do it, what's going on with the nurses? And all that was really happening was no one was communicating. And through simulation, what we've realized is we've now encouraged the nurses to speak up, to say, well, team leader, we actually have prepared ketamine, and there are no contraindications for this patient to use ketamine. Would this be acceptable because we have it available now? Versus if you want me to get the etomidate, it will take us an extra 3 or 4 minutes. And vice versa, the team leader now walks into scenarios and says, oh, so where are you guys at, and what do you guys suggest should be the next step? And so it's really been, subjectively a very positive experience in us working together as a team. It's been about 4 years now, I think, that we've been doing this, and while we didn't set up any objective measures at the onset, subjectively, I do believe that our department is functioning a lot more collaboratively and offering guidance and expertise across professional boundaries as a result. Just last week, I heard a situation in which a patient came in with a tachyarrhythmia into the crash room. And in our context, tachyarrhythmias are supraventricular tachycardia until proven otherwise. And that was how they were operating. And the nurse looked at the ECG, looked at the monitor, and said, you know, the QRS interval seems wide, and I think this is a wide complex tachycardia. And through a very collaborative assessment, the team successfully identified a life-threatening emergency and was able to avert any further harm to the patient. But it is through simulations and interprofessional training that we now encouraged our nurses and our physicians to use closed-loop communication, shared mental models and situational awareness, the use of graded assertiveness, as Mark was highlighting earlier, empowering everyone to speak up on the team, teaching the team leaders how to do so effectively while ensuring a flattened hierarchy and ensuring that there's collaboration occurring across the disciplines and professions. Another setting that I work in is on the inpatient care units, where I get there at 8 a.m., we get the handover from the night docs, and then we start rounding as a medical team at the bedside. Now, when I say my medical team, it's my 3 or 4 medical students working with 3 or 4 residents, myself. We actually have made a step forward in the past year or two where we have pharmacy rounding with us. Where we're lacking right now is we haven't found the solution to how to get nurses and the physicians and the pharmacists at the same time rounding together. And what results? So I get to the bedside of this 6-month-old baby who has recurrent aspiration pneumonias and is now being fed through an NG tube and is being geared up for the home enteral feeding program. So I say to my medical assistant, I say, so what's the plan today? And she says to me, well, the patient should be ready for discharge today. We're just waiting for the final nursing teachings to occur. Perfect. Great. I ensured flow of the hospital, and let's move forward. Get back to the next day, and what happens? The patient is still there. So I say to my student, I say, what happened? She says, oh, there's some nursing issue. I say, well, what is the nursing issue? She said, I don't know. And now that annoyed me as an attending. And so I said, okay, so let's call the nurse and see if he's available to come and speak with us. And fortunately, he was. And so we rounded at that particular instance together. And he explained to me that the family is struggling with their jobs, their other children, their other responsibilities, and listed out all the problems that were happening for the patients and their families coping with this situation. And his opinion was that we needed to do X, Y, and Z to make things happen, and it would take another week. And we exchanged a couple of suggestions back and forth, and together we collaborated on an effective care plan for this patient and their family. Now, what went wrong? Why did my medical team miss the boat? Why did the nursing team didn't communicate this sooner? I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but I know that the issue is a systems one, because we need to overcome these barriers that are many and start rounding as interprofessional teams. As a physician, when I get there at that 9 a.m. rounds, I'm thinking in a particular way. I'm gathering my information about the history, the physical, the diagnosis, the labs, and I'm recommending a treatment plan. But I'm not there the rest of the day administering the treatment plan. Most of the time, I'm not hanging out at the bedside for the rest of the 23 hours of the day. It is the nurses and the families that are there. And it is the nurses collaborating with the patient at the bedside. And so it is that team, the nurses and the families, that are best positioned to notice what's working well and where things need to be adjusted and improved. Another story that actually just happened very recently as well is we admitted a 5-week-old baby with pertussis. Now, in the first month or two, babies who get pertussis have a high mortality rate. They die. They stop breathing, they get pulmonary hypertension, and they could die. And we admitted this baby because he had a coughing fit in which he stopped breathing for a few seconds. Not a big deal. And we said, we'll watch him in hospital in case it evolves. Day one, day two, day three, things are a little bit more frequent. But we say, no problem. And then one morning I get there, and the head nurse comes to find me and says, Sasha, you know, the patient has frequent apneas and bradycardias. They're severe. It's requiring very frequent care, and I really suggest we get an ICU consult and transfer the baby. Of course I agree, no problem. But I go through the nursing, the chart nonetheless, and I say, and I realize that it's actually been happening for 24 to 36 hours. But I don't know what happened that didn't get communicated somehow to my team, whether it is my team, the medical docs didn't communicate the situation. Maybe there wasn't a shared understanding of what really was the patient's issues and what our concerns were. Maybe there was no mechanism in place for the nurses to communicate to the physicians. And what this was is what I'd call a near miss. And the leap, so I think we need to move towards interprofessional rounds to avoid these near misses. And the leap to interprofessional rounds and collaboration can start on individual care teams, and it should. However, we need to assess how we are trained to communicate at the school level. As doctors, I've been trained to talk in very succinct point form, objective medical diagnosis with a trajectory to a treatment plan. Nursing, as I've been told, is trained to communicate to meet the nursing needs, to more narrative, subjective, objective, yet collectively. These nursing diagnoses, which I don't get either. And care maps, which I haven't been trained to even look at. And what occurs then is doctors and nurses meet, and there's a clash of style. And as Mark Daly had suggested, what we need to do is agree on some structured communication strategy, be it ISBAR or any other mechanism. The key is that we agree we're going to prepare for the communications, and we're going to talk the same language and the same style. So a nurse will come up to me and, you know, kind of say, oh, you know, the patient with sickle cell, with pain crisis, with fever, now has oxygen need. I have no idea where she's going or he's going. And half the time I tune out because I'm an emerge doc with, you know, a 1-minute attention span. And so it's not the question of the phone going dead in the dead zones of the hospital. It's more my attention span. Anyways, versus using the situation up front. Hi, Sasha. I'm calling because Johnny in bed such and such developed acute hypoxia and respiratory distress. I'm very worried. I need you to come now. The background is this was the sickler, et cetera, et cetera. I recommend we get a PICU consult, a stat chest x-ray, and I'll see you in a few minutes. And I would then read back to this particular person on the communication and say, this is what I've got. I understood you want us to do. And we would make sure we had a shared understanding. Now, moreover, what's very interesting is many docs, even in the year 2012, we don't get how nurses think. We don't necessarily get that nurses don't just go and give them medications and give bedpans, that when there's a medication that's being administered, that there have been thought put into it. Is it indicated? Is it contraindicated? What is the correct dosage? What are the side effect pros, the pharmacokinetics of the medication, so that anticipation of side effects and prevention of any morbidities or mortalities will occur. And it wasn't until I got to my graduation in 2004 at the Faculty of Medicine where I looked around the room and I didn't know almost anybody other than my own class. And there were professionals from pharmacy, from nursing, from OT, PT, the proud parents taking pictures. And I wondered, I remember they're sitting, what did they just do for the past 3 to 4 years in their training? And how come we didn't overlap at any point? And what are they actually going to do? We've been trained in isolation for decades, if not centuries. Our schools are on opposite end of the McGill campus. And it is through the grassroots that we will be able to ensure that we change the culture of how we work together. We need to move towards a more collaborative learning experience from the onset. That is when we can ensure that we understand each other's roles, each other's strengths, each other's weaknesses, because we each have those, both of those elements. We need to learn to communicate in the learning environment and continue to develop our professional expertise collaboratively throughout our professional work experiences. That is when we'll be able to communicate with each other on equal terms, with no hierarchical barriers. So what are the 5 W's of what physicians need to hear? I need to know who it's about, what happened, when and where, why did it happen, and most importantly, I need to know, what do you suggest? Now, many of you may ask why I put this plane crash at the beginning of my presentation, and I'd like to explain to you a very brief scenario that happened in 1977 off the Canary Islands. Some of you may have remember this plane crash, but there was a bomb scare at the major airport. They diverted planes to a very small airfield, not equipped or experienced to deal with large aircrafts or large volumes. They used walkie-talkies with static. They used visibility, and it was a very cloudy day. So there's a lot of little elements that were starting to line up to create a disaster. What's more is the air traffic controller essentially said to the pilot, "You are ready to prepare for takeoff." The pilot heard, "I am ready for takeoff," and started taking off. So they didn't have a closed loop or a structured communication strategy. Moreover, the co-pilot and the air traffic controller, apparently they caught on to that subtlety, but there was no culture in the cockpit for them to speak up. And what resulted is about 600 deaths. And the airline industry has then moved to a culture of safety, to crew resource management training, and they've decreased fatalities per flight departure from 40 per million to less than 1 in 10 million. Each of us knows it's a lot safer to get on a plane these days than to drive our car. And it's because they've went and they've put time and effort and work to create a culture of safety. We don't need to reinvent the wheel in healthcare. We need to learn from our colleagues in these so-called high reliability organizations. Accidents are expected to happen, and so they create systems in place to make sure they don't. Every individual working in the institution, from the guy who cleans the windows of the helicopter, putting air into the tires, putting gas into the fuselage, preparing the bolts and whatnot, the pilot, the air traffic controller, the guy cleaning the whatever it is, each of them knows that if they do not do their job properly, if they do not communicate effectively, a major disaster will occur. And they work in teams, and they have communication training on a regular basis. And they have, most importantly, a culture of safety. What do we need to do? We need to break down the silos in all spheres of healthcare, from where we learn to where we care for patients, where we research and study processes, to administration, and importantly, where we socialize with each other. It is through, and once we start training and working collaboratively as a team, it is then that we will cross the finish line, having achieved the goal of being able to deliver effective and safe patient and family-centered care. I'd like to end you with this quote that's not necessarily a communications quote, but I like the quote nonetheless from Dr. Seuss. Be who you are and say what you feel. Those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind. Thank you very much.